battle stations. Battle stations.
The National Broadcasting Company's Department of Special Events, cooperating with the United States Navy, presents the third of a series of programs to tell you of your Navy, its accomplishments, its history, its heroes, and its hopes, under the title Battle Stations. Tonight, the Navy's Air Arm.
I've lost my program. Would you tell me what these flying machines are to do?
Why, sure. This is the missile dropping. The flyer will be competing to see which can drop his missile closest to the mark you see in the infield.
Oh, thanks.
1910, and the sports-minded folks living around Hale Corp, Maryland, have come in great crowds to enjoy the latest sport, flying. The flying man is stretching his wings, emerging from the chrysalis, and his daring has given sport a new thrill.
What is the object of this event? Must they be at a certain height when the missile is dropped?
Yeah, I believe that's it. This is a new event.
A silent naval officer has followed the progress of the aviation meet with rapt attention. He does not join in the cheers of the crowd. His eyes are fixed not on the far reaches of this day's sky, but on the horizon, the future. Argosies of magic sails that Tennyson had described 68 years before. Airy navies grappling in the central blue had been the poet's prophetic words. This is Captain Washington Irving Chambers of the United States Navy. The man who sits beside him has enthusiastic comment, which he directs to anyone whose eye he catches. The man has turned to Captain Chambers.
This chap is taking enough time to get over the mark, eh?
Huh? Yes, but I suppose that's necessary in maneuvering an airship.
There, he drops it! Oh. That was close. No more than 15 feet from the mark. I'd say that takes a knack.
Indeed it must.
This is going to develop into quite a sport, or I miss my guess.
And maybe quite a bit more than that. Excuse me.
Oh, are you leaving now?
Captain Chambers left the stands and walked rapidly to the building at one end of the field where planes were receiving last-minute repairs.
Pardon me, but could you tell me where I'll find Mr. Wright, Mr. Wilbur Wright?
Oh, he ain't at the field now. But there's some of his troop of flyers about, sir.
Would you know how I can reach him?
Well, there's a telephone in the office. You can call him at it.
Mr. Wright, this is Captain W.I. Chambers.
Hello, Captain.
I've corresponded with you, if you'll remember.
Yes, I remember. You're with the Navy.
I'd like to talk with you again. That matter of launching an aircraft from aboard a fighting ship.
No good, Captain. I don't think we're ready for that as yet.
Well, perhaps not, Mr. Wright. But let me have one of your flyers, and we'll give it a try anyway.
No, I'm afraid I have to refuse, Captain. No.
Each of Chambers' many arguments met with a no. Each successive refusal was spoken with greater finality. The discouraged naval officer left the hangar building.
Gentlemen, the time is now. There is a place in the Navy for aircraft.
That may be very true with the Army, Chambers. Very interesting, that missile dropping you saw, but the Navy fights its actions in mid-ocean.
Right. Heaven help us if we ever allow an enemy fleet to get close enough to our shore so that aircraft could drop missiles on its units.
But aircraft can go to sea with the ships. Now, Mr. Eugene Ely here is willing to fly the plane as an experiment from the deck of one of our ships. Isn't that right, Ely?
I'm willing to try. I think it can be done.
Ely's a sound flyer. He's been with Curtis, now he's on his own. I'm confident the airplane belongs in our Navy, even if it's used only for scouting. Noah had his dove. He was ahead of us in the matter of scouting.
Well, I agree with you this far. It should be given a trial.
Well, let's see what we can do.
You sure this message is correct? Has it been verified?
Yes, sir. I had it repeated.
USS Birmingham proceed to Norfolk to be at disposal of Captain Chambers for aircraft launching experiment.
Naval constructor William McEntee tackled his job with relish. He had looked forward for months to this project. The platform he designed sloped downward to the bow and hung out over the water, 37 feet from the surface.
This is a hell of a Navy! If they want to keep us out of the sun, why don't they just rig up an awning?
Anybody'd want to fly a flag? fly machine off this is great.
The men aren't quite as confident as you, Mr. Ealing.
So I hear.
You seem to have done a very good job, McKenzie. At least it seems that way to me.
Well, 83 feet long. That won't give you a run of much more than 55 feet with your plane on the platform, Ealing.
Well, with a downslope to pick up speed, I think that'll be long enough. I'm ready, Captain Chambers. The 14th of November will be all right with me.
All right, men, I know you haven't had breakfast yet, but there's a job to do. We're hoisting Mr. Ealy's airplane aboard.
Grim skies frowned down on the Norfolk Harbor where the Navy was to try on its wings, and everyone aboard the Birmingham was obviously nervous.
The weather isn't going to get any better. Worse, if anything. I'd better start before it does get worse.
I'm not sure it wouldn't be wise to wait for another day, Ealy.
No, if airplanes are to be of any use, they'll have to operate in all weather. I wouldn't want to be the cause of wasting the day for all those destroyers. No, I don't mean quite that. I hope their day will be wasted. I'd rather not have to be picked up out of the water by one of them.
At 3 o'clock, Ealy, wearing a life preserver, his cap turned around with the bill to the back, goggles over his eyes, climbed to his place in the aircraft. As the engine raced, Captain Chambers, watching from the bridge, was electrified when the craft was seen to start down the platform.
Ealy wasn't ready. He didn't give the release signal. He just nodded to the mechanic. He hasn't enough speed.
But it was too late to stop the plane, now rolling down the incline. Ealy has seemed to tense as the end of the platform near, then he feels no upward lift. Then the plane is plunging down, diving toward the swollen waters of the Chesapeake. He pulls back on the elevator and the craft quivers and begins to level off. The engine fights to pull the craft up above the chopping waves. Too late, for the wheels have touched the surface. Both tips of the propeller have knifed the water. The spray covers Ealy.
The craft's pulling up! It's over the water! It's flying!
The craft was flying. Its propeller blade splintered, but it was flying. And for the first time, a navy of the world had wings. Captain Chambers was exultant to see the first of his visions realized.
Every cruiser should be equipped with planes. This is the beginning.
On this day, a sound reverberates. Wings over water. And the sound will have a thunderous echo in years to come. Planes aloft from sea carriers. Not one, but many. Today, this day in November 1910, the United States Navy has been given sharper eyes and a new striking force. But on this day, not all naval authorities agreed on the place of aviation in the Navy. But it was agreed that it might be well for the Navy to have at least one flyer.
There it is, Ellison. Is it what you want? Now, here, don't you want to read the order?
Yes, sir. Thank you, sir. I'm to be trained to fly?
The Navy Department has accepted Gren Curtis's offer to teach one Navy man. You're the one, Lieutenant.
Number one on the roll of Navy flyers, Lieutenant Theodore G. Ellison. These were starts, the launching and the acquiring of a flyer. But resistance remained. Doubters were unconvinced.
We can't build platforms on all our cruisers.
Sure they can get into the air from ships. How are you going to get them back?
Right. No, we can't waste any money on it until these flying machines can land in water and go up off it. Or land on the ships some way. I guess that's quite a way off yet.
Quite a way off? No. Chambers' vision went far beyond the initial success. He'd gone to Glenn Curtis with the plans he had made to fly a land plane onto a naval vessel.
Well, the plan looks very feasible to me, Chambers. You say you've got permission to have the landing platform built?
Yes, on the Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. Pennsylvania will be in San Francisco this month. Ely's eager to have a try at it.
Well, if you ask me, I think Ely's the right man. Yes, I'll say he is.
A lot depends on the success of this experiment. Aviation in the service will be pushed quite a way along. It will end a lot of doubts.
You Eugene Ely is at the controls of his plane. He took off a few minutes ago from the airfield at Tanforan and is headed now to an appointment with destiny. The USS Pennsylvania is headed toward the Golden Gate. Five-knot wind is rushing down the bay as Ely's plane climbs over the San Bruno Hills. He will have to make his landing under the worst possible conditions, downwind. He sees the 120-foot superstructure platform. He sees canvas nets spread out on both sides of the landing strips and swimmers ready to dive in and swim to his aid if something goes wrong. Lines across the deck show him the arresting ropes are in place, ready to be caught up by three pairs of steel hooks fastened to his craft beneath him. Well astern of the Pennsylvania, Ely turns toward his landing field, the smallest on which a landing had ever been attempted.
Stand by!
How does it look to you, Curtis?
Well, the tailwind has shifted across the course, Captain. That's not so good. He's going to have trouble making a straight approach to the deck.
He seems to be steadying down, though.
Yes, he has his eye on the center line.
Those arresting lines aren't going to stop that craft at the speed it's going. He's got to catch one of the first of them, or he'll go into the barrier.
Now look, he's pulling up. He'll clear the ramp. Good flying.
He's setting down. He's picking up the arresting lines. The drag is doing it.
The plane struggles with the drag of the pairs of 50-pound sandbags. Then, with 50 feet to spare, comes to a complete stop. The aircraft carrier has been born. The cosmic keels have been laid for the Lexington, Wasp, Saratoga, Hornet, Enterprise, the dozens of others that have carried, will carry, the Navy wings to victory. That night aboard the Pennsylvania.
Yes, sir, we have an answer now to every objection that has been raised, unless they think of some new ones.
Yes, you didn't even need the entire platform, Ely.
Well, no, I didn't, but I don't think a smaller one would be safe.
If the ship had been in motion and sailing into the wind, it would have been easier, don't you think so?
You bet it would. I'm proud that this took place on a ship in my command. This has made a believer out of me.
Oh, I hope you mean that, Captain Pond.
If you ever see my report on this, you'll know.
Gentlemen! I'd say a toast is in order.
You, Captain Chambers, this is your triumph, yours and Ely's.
Gentlemen, a toast to our healthy orphan, Naval Aviation.
With these notable triumphs to its name, Naval Aviation is still an orphan, but gaining enthusiasts. For example,
as a result of this experiment and my observation of the aviation field, I desire to place myself on record as positively assured of the importance of the airplane in future naval warfare. Signed, Captain C.F. Pond, USS Pennsylvania.
The boards of strategy of all important sea powers had eyes on these uncertain pioneer developments of the air fighters of the sea, and the developments came rapidly. A week after Ely's daring demonstration, Glenn Curtis was seen by excited Sunday picnickers along the Coronado shores, skimming over the surf in a strange flying machine that was supported in the water by small boats. The craft lifted from the water, and the crowd was seeing a successful flight by a hydroplane. Old Line Navy men blinked, and the conditions of acceptance became fewer. Secretary of the Navy Meyer, who had been immune to the infection of Chambers' enthusiasm, wrote to Curtis,
"When you show me that it is feasible for an airplane to alight alongside a battleship and be hoisted aboard without any false deck to receive it, I shall believe the airplane of practical value to the Navy."
Challenge. Spark to the volatile champions of naval aircraft. 3 weeks after the test of his hydroplane, Glenn Curtis flew over the USS Pennsylvania lying at anchor in San Diego Bay and signaled he would like to come aboard. Captain Pond's response? Come ahead. And within a few minutes, Curtis was alongside the Pennsylvania. Within a few more, the boat's crane was hooked on the sidings, on the slings on the upper wings, and hoisted aboard. A condition was met, and a promise was kept.
I had hoped for more. But with an appropriation of $25,000, we can be reasonably sure we'll have one aircraft for our one pilot.
Pioneering success is a moving target, and Captain Chambers found new objections to be met hard on the heels of each development.
Aircraft will never be any use to a battleship if they need the entire deck for a takeoff platform.
In the summer of 1911, Chambers had one pilot, two student aviators, Rogers and Towers, and three planes on order. A few months later, he had established a naval aviation camp across the Severn River from the United States Naval Academy. Pilots two and three on the Navy roll had finished their training and joined Chambers in tackling the next problem.
Well, there it is, men. There's a piece of almost every type of equipment in the service. adapted to some use in that rig. A discarded torpedo tube, a scrapped air tank, and part of the hoisting gear from the old USS Oregon. But it embodies the idea I think will make a catapult.
Yeah, I'm itching to try it, sir, if you say the word.
There's a lot of work to be done on it, Ellison. I'm not even sure it'll be tried at all.
I don't believe what the doctors say, Captain. I can be shot from that and remain conscious.
Am I correct in assuming you're volunteering for a try at it?
You bet I am, whenever you say, sir.
But Lieutenant Ellison was not to have the distinction of being the first human to be propelled from a catapult. A group of sailors who had overheard the conversation between Chambers and Ellison had an idea of their own, and at nightfall returned to the dock with a young new friend.
So your name's Bill, huh?
Yes, sir.
I hear you're quite an authority on the weather, Bill. Ain't that what you heard, Nick?
Uh-huh. That's what I heard. Quite an authority.
Gosh, I didn't know I had that reputation.
Oh, you have, yes, sir. What do you reckon the weather will be tomorrow?
I guess fair.
Here, sit on this, Bill. You can lean back comfortable.
Thank you, sir, but I just...
We'll be sitting beside you in just a minute, Bill. I want to have a private word with my friend first, though. Excuse us?
Oh, yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Reckon we ought to do it?
I got a powerful hankering to know.
He ain't sitting square in the middle of the catapult car.
I'll fix that. Bill, you can be moving to the center of that thing you're sitting on so we can sit right down. We're through talking.
If we're gonna, we gotta do it fast.
You get that air, Bill? You comfortable, Bill?
Yes, sir. Real comfortable.
I'm glad.
Look at him go.
Man, oh, man, he went like a bullet.
I reckon he was dead when he hit the water?
I don't know.
What in the world happened?
You all right, Bill?
I'm wet.
Wet, but undeniably alive and conscious. The unofficial experimenters paid for their foreknowledge with a hard night of work recovering the catapult car from the bottom and cleaning it. But the following morning, they exchanged knowing glances when, standing by the hydroplane mounted on the catapult, they overheard Captain Chambers' nervous words to Lieutenant Ellison.
Now, the men in the boats will be on hand to help you if the force of the acceleration renders you unconscious, Ellison.
I don't think I'll need the help, sir. After all the work you've put into this catapult, I hope I won't.
I hope so.
Well, now let's get to work.
The engine racing at its top speed, the air compressor tank ready to expend its force, Ellison's hand is lowered. The signal, and a hammer strikes the release valve.
He's conscious, sir! He's fighting with the elevator!
The crosswind's catching the craft, but he's conscious. The catapult will work.
He's conscious, Texas.
Uh-huh, he sure is.
Surprised?
Uh-huh, you bet I am.
The takeoff from a catapult proved the principle. The last objection to aircraft taking a place on men of war was pushed aside, and the time had come for aviation to take an authorized place in the United States Navy.
The appointments to the Board of Aeronautics, your signature is required, Mr. Roosevelt.
Franklin Roosevelt's signature put a Board of Aeronautics to work drawing up comprehensive plans for the organization of a Naval Aeronautics Service, and the air arm had become an official part of the United States Navy. With the coming of the First World War, the air arm faced a thousand new problems, some of which were solved in action, some posed for later solution. At the war's end, the Navy's newcomer looked back on a short but important record of advance. Advance with one alarming failure. A German U-boat had surfaced one Sunday morning off Cape Cod, and in sight of land, started firing shells into a tug-drawn group of barges. A hurried call was made to the nearby naval air station. The flying boat pilots had had many alarms. All had proved to be false reports. This time, as the HS boat swept down along the shore, a U-boat was sighted, making hasty preparations to dive.
Good Lord, it is a submarine.
Yeah, and is this going to be easy?
It's up to you.
The mechanic worked his way out on the wing to the bomb racks. Lying flat, he reached under the wing and released the bomb. Straight for the bow of the sub. 200 pounds of TNT.
Oh, a dud. I hit a square and the bomb was a dud.
That was the last hit scored by the flying boats. The problem of accuracy in bomb dropping was one that would not be solved until after the war. But it was solved. ...1919. Lieutenant, now Major L.H. Sanderson of the United States Marine Corps, leads a group of fellow pilots across a flying field in Haiti.
Hey, what's this all about, Sanderson? Couldn't you just tell us about it?
Nope, you gotta see it. Okay, have a look.
A look? A look at what?
My ship. Look under the fuselage. Hmm? By the wheels.
By the wheels? What in the devil is that?
Now, we haven't been able to come within a mile of the thing we aim at with our bombs, the way we're dropping them now. What do you think of this for an idea?
Well, if hanging a flour sack under your fuselage is an idea, I'm glad I don't produce them.
Now, wait before you hop on it. Look, I put a bomb in here, and I pull this drawstring to keep it in.
Yeah?
Then I'm up in the air. I spot a target. I dive on it. And on the way down, I yank the drawstring. The sack opens, and the bomb goes on down in the direction I was diving.
Until it reaches your prop. At which time, you get yourself blowed to hell.
One time out of ten. I'm going to try it.
One to ten was good odds to a man who pioneered in combat flying techniques. The trial was a success, and dive bombing was born, and a sound was heard that was amplified in the years to come. ...1919 was the year of another of the Navy Air Arms' notable firsts. Aviation had reached the stage in which an air crossing of the Atlantic was believed possible, and enthusiasts on both sides of the ocean were eager to be the first to accomplish the feat. Three British teams of flyers were already at St. John's, Newfoundland, preparing for transatlantic attempts. When the Navy's veteran pilots saw the first of four planes on order, the NC-1, the challenge fairly cried for acceptance. Commander Jack Towers, breath suspended, when he opened and read an order.
Special duty, report to Rockaway Beach, proposed transatlantic flight.
Putty Reed, now Rear Admiral Reed, received a like order. So did Pat Bellinger, now Rear Admiral Bellinger. And the NC-1, NC-3, and NC-4 were put in readiness for the flight. From the moment of the first takeoff, the NC-4 showed signs of a contrary nature. Ill fortune piled up for the ship, and only the bad weather that held up the other planes at Cape Pine allowed it to be there when the three planes took the air, headed out across the Atlantic. Now the Azores lie behind NC-4, and Reed, Towers, and Bellinger pushed their planes on to Lisbon, on to Plymouth, receiving the cheers reserved for the first flyers to cross the Atlantic. ...1943 sees Navy flying boats almost daily crossing the Atlantic with dispatches, medical supplies. Perhaps it was one of the things envisioned by Captain Washington Irving Chambers as he sat watching an air meet in Halethorpe, Maryland, that day in 1910. He had dreamed of navies of the air, but he could not have foreseen all that came about. December 6, 1941. The aircraft carrier USS Enterprise had been on a secret mission for several months. Weather had delayed it. So instead of arriving on Saturday, as had been expected, the planes of Scouting Squadron 6, now warming motors on the flight deck, will be in Sunday morning. The crews of Squadron 6 await the takeoff with eagerness.
Gosh, you're as sped up as I am, Mr. Clark.
I can certainly use that nice juicy leave.
You can say that again for me, mister. I've got radio cauliflowered ears. That's what I got. How much leave you reckon you're going to get?
Long enough. Hope it'll be 5 months.
That don't seem too long to me after a 4-year tour of duty.
Say, this may be our last flight together. Hope not, though. You're a swell rear seat man.
Make it good. You've been real nice about keeping me out of the drink. Got so I'd like keeping dry. Oh, your radio check's okay, sir.
The plane handlers moved the sleek ships with precision to the line. Precision was an Enterprise watchword. The nation was at peace, but Scout Squadron 6 carried out each maneuver with battle briskness.
Section 4, up. Section 4.
Pilot looks to his rear seat man, grins, winks. This is the last one for a while, the wink says. A flash of color, the signal, and a plane 31 years, 1 month away in time, 6,000 miles away in distance from Ely's plunge from the Birmingham's deck. This plane rises smoothly, evenly. There's power to spare. Scout Squadron 6 is making a historic flight. 18 of its planes soar into a sky of peace to come down, some of them in flames, an hour later as they come into Pearl Harbor as the Japanese Air Force is striking its first treacherous blow, December 7th, 1941. Standing by in Norfolk, Virginia, is Rear Admiral Patrick N.L. Bellinger, USN, one of the first naval officers to fly, and holder of the official designation, Naval Aviator No. 8. Today, Rear Admiral Bellinger, truly a pioneer in naval aviation, is Commander Air Force Atlantic Fleet, and is concerned with anti-submarine warfare in the Atlantic. He speaks to you from Norfolk.
Back in World War I,
It was thought that naval aviation did well if it could get planes out and keep the Kaiser's U-boats down temporarily. Now, in World War II, this situation is rather different. We're definitely not satisfied unless we can get this U-boat down, not temporarily, but permanently. 30-odd years ago, in the experimental piano wire and glue stage, naval aviation got scant attention, but it has grown in that short time to one of the major striking forces in the fleet. Everyone who has contributed to this new and powerful weapon, in the factories or in the laboratories, in the air or on the ground, can be proud of what naval planes have done all over the world and what they are doing now in the Pacific. For out there, naval aviation is playing a tremendous part in the gathering offensive against Japan. The men who fight from the flat tops are proving the wisdom of that American investment of sweat, money, and material. Here in the Atlantic area, which happens to be my bailiwick, our planes and crews have been assigned a tough job, and they're doing it better as each week goes by. I do not minimize the number of enemy submarines still at large, nor the resourcefulness and determination of the enemy. One good month of U-boat sinkings does not mean that he is licked, but there has been a huge drop in merchant vessel losses since 1942. The number of U-boats permanently berthed on the bottom continues to increase. You have heard recently how planes from an escort carrier, called simply Carrier B for the time being, scored 2 sunk and 8 probables out of 11 attacks within a few days. There are several other escort carriers which have not come home empty-handed. That goes for patrol bombers and blimps as well. There are no parts of the ocean now which are safe for enemy submarines. No places that cannot be reached either by patrol bombers of all types, escort carrier planes, or blimps. To a large extent, the planes from our bases encircling the Atlantic have driven the U-boats far out to sea. And in deep water, our escort carriers, acting in close cooperation with surface ships, are getting convoys through. That is our big job, to get the men and materials across. Naval aviation was a decisive factor in safeguarding the deliveries that made the victories of Tunisia and Sicily possible, and it will be until the challenge of the U-boat is permanently licked.
Thank you, Admiral Bellinger. Next Thursday at this same time, the United States Navy and NBC's Department of Special Events will bring you the 4th and final program in this series, Battle Stations, telling the stirring story of the Navy's air arm in World War II. Next Thursday on Battle Stations. This script was written by Charles Gussman. The music was composed, scored, and directed by Leo Kempinski. And the production was under the direction of Joseph Mansfield. This program came to you from Norfolk and New York. This is the National Broadcasting Company.